Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Basketball was a big deal for the small town of North Fork in McDowell County, West Virginia. Their high school team won the state championship 8 years in a row.
Little old ladies who didn't know what would know basketball from football became, you know, big fans because it brought positive notoriety and attention to the community.
When they came back from a championship game, there was a cavalcade of people standing out on the streets, you know, welcoming them back.
Yet, despite its success on the basketball court, North Fork was closed after local politicians voted to consolidate the high schools in McDowell County.
The way Jim Lane, our principal, found out about it was one of the board members who had voted against it called him that night and told him that, quote, "We closed your high school tonight." He wasn't even aware of the fact that they were even going to consider it, let alone, you know, vote on it.
North Fork High was just one of thousands of schools that have closed across the country in recent decades. Declining population in rural Appalachia has made this especially common for our region as school boards struggle to consolidate resources. But when a school is closed, the community often grieves.
I mean, there was a lot of weeping and mourning going on. It was a terrible loss, and I don't think people have gotten over it.
Today we'll explore how consolidation of schools affects community pride and participation in extracurricular activities like sports. That's coming up this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. During the past 50 years, many people in coal country have watched as their towns have faded to mere shadows of what they used to be. As mines shut down and jobs left, hundreds of coal towns have wasted away. Schools often serve as a kind of anchor for small towns. When those schools close, it can mean the beginning of a town's decline. The stories surrounding school consolidation aren't only here in Appalachia, though. A consolidation movement during the past few decades has changed how a lot of rural Americans interact with school pride and how communities are involved with their local schools. School consolidation is when school districts close two or more schools for educational or economic benefits. But in communities already in economic decline, the closing of a local school can have long-term ripple effects for the people who live there. McDowell County, West Virginia, for example, has been among the hardest hit. The population has decreased by almost 17% since 2010. Where once there were thriving businesses and lively communities, there's little that looks the same. We'll spend the first half of today's show hearing the story about North Fork High School through the lens of its basketball team's rise to fame.
I think definitely, and not only the excitement, but of course there is much more on the line for the North Fork Blue Demons. The Demons, they have won 7 out of the last 9 championships in AA, and they're going to tie...
The school was quite famous during the 1970s and 80s, winning 8 state basketball championships in a row during one particularly successful stretch. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's John Hale has family roots in this community. Our producer Roxy Todd sat down with him to hear about the story he uncovered about North Fork High.
So this story, which we'll hear in just a minute, is a really personal one for you and your family. You returned back to your family's home of North Fork, and most of you have since moved away. But this is where you all call home, essentially. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I moved from North Fork when I was relatively young, but we still had family and everyone who lived down in North Fork. My mother taught at Switchback Elementary, which was a elementary school down there. And when I was little, my godmother was actually still in Algoma. So, and my grandparents live in Algoma. So even though we didn't live there, you know, it was almost like it was my second home.
So North Fork actually didn't become a high school until 1966, as far as I understand. Essentially, it was consolidated right after integration became law and the black school merged with the white school. And now your uncles went to school a few years after that. What did they remember from this time in terms of how racial integration kind of played out in their community?
My two uncles, David McDaniel and Mark Page, we called him Uncle Joe, they said they really didn't notice much of a change when integration happened due to the, you know, community itself being pretty much well-knit and, you know, tied together.
And would you describe your two uncles for us?
Yes. My Uncle David, tall, I say about 6'5", kind of a lanky build. He is life of a party. he could probably go in a room and not only draw attention to himself, but also, you know, make sure everyone is having a good time. My other uncle, Uncle Joe, he was a little bit more reserved, but he had a sense of humor that was real, real low key. That was one of the best things that that I remember about him.
And one of the other people you talked to for this story is Carol Sizemore. Tell us a little bit about her.
Carol's a longtime resident, and she's the current mayor of Norfolk. She has been there since the very beginning. She remembers all of the sights and sounds of Norfolk, and she remembers how great the community was back in the day.
We had a drugstore. We had a Masonic building. We had a wonderful high school, a few nice restaurants. So it was just a meeting place, a social meeting place for everybody to come, because when I was young in that time, this was like a metropolitan area.
And your uncles told you a similar story about when McDowell County was doing really well, coal was booming, and there were a lot of businesses and a lot of people back in the 60s and 70s. Let's pick back up. I think there's a story your Uncle David told you about when coal was doing really well.
Yeah, my Uncle David remembers that back when McDowell County in the 60s and 70s, when the coal fields were booming, it seemed like they had everything that they could ever want. It was filled with stores and restaurants, and there was a really, really big car dealership down there called Carroll Motors. That was everyone's local car dealership. And the mines were doing so well in the 60s that he worked as a coal miner over the summer, and he made some really good money. And I mean really good.
The money was so good, I bought me a 68 Plymouth Roadrunner with 2 paydays. So when I went back to school, after that summer, I was the man. You know, I was the man. But life was good around here, man. It was really good.
Coal was king in McDowell County in the 60s and 70s. At one point, this county is one of the richest in the country due to coal production. There were more than 53 communities that either had their own mines or housed miners who worked in the area. The coal mines attracted workers from all over the country, even the world. So there was a pretty diverse group of people in McDowell, from what my Uncle Joe remembers.
Everybody knew everybody. It wasn't that, you know, there wasn't any hate in the air. You know, it wasn't any racial tensions and all that stuff. No, you know, we didn't have, at least as far as I'm concerned, the Italians, the whites, the blacks, we all got along great.
But athletes were probably treated better than non-athletes, given their status in the community. David admits that he only realized later that Norfolk may have been more segregated than he realized.
With me getting attention on who I was, I didn't know racial things happened until I got older and I heard some of other people's stories. Even the principal, they say he used to carry a gun. I didn't know this. I was a basketball star at the time, and I got along with white folks and black folks. I really didn't see it because even the principal, even the police officer, the store owners, the dry cleaner man, the smokehouse man, everybody treated me well. And I just thought that's the way it was. But after I grew up and started hearing other people's stories on what used to go around here, but I do remember the movie theater, the Freeman Theater, we always sat in the back. White folks sat up front.
David may have been isolated from some of the tensions that were present, but there were a lot of African Americans in Norfolk in the 1960s. He and Joe both grew up in a little community called Algoma, just outside of town.
40 or 50 families, and at least, and you're talking maybe 3 or 4 white on the ends, and everybody else is black. Black families. Yeah, there's a lot of families there, and all black, in that one community.
Algoma was a small community. If you blinked, you might not notice you drove through it. When they were kids, Joe and David played without any blacktop or asphalt, just dirt. They lovingly referred to those games as Dust Bowl games. I went out to Algoma to check out the site where they once played basketball on their makeshift court.
Certain neighborhoods around here had playgrounds. In my neighborhood, we didn't. We created our own playground. Even when we played basketball, we used to have to go up in the mountain, cut our tree. We'd go get a metal tabletop and tack it onto that tree, and that'd be our backboard. We made our own stuff around here, man, all the way.
We played in the summertime. We played in the fall. We played in the winter. I can remember waiting for the snow to stop one time, and I wanted to be the first one up there to shoot the ball and knock the snow off the nets. So, I just couldn't wait to get up to that basketball court. And I can still today remember that feeling that, hey, I made that shot.
There were no streetlights, so not only did they have to get creative with the materials they use, they also had to be resourceful when it came to lighting the court.
And we had a curve. When the car come around the curve, it'll shine it on the goal, and then we'll shoot when the light hit the goal.
All those hours playing basketball paid off for David and Joe. They both made the high school team, and although they played during different years, each would be responsible for making history in Norfolk. More about that in a minute. But first, I need to tell you about their coach, Jennings Boyd.
Play as a team. Do the things we're supposed to do. The ball game's not over. Understand, it's a 10-point game, fellas. It's 6 minutes to play yet. That's a good basketball team that you're playing. Now wake up and let's go.
Jennings Boyd was a math teacher at Norfolk High School. Not only did he apply his analytical teachings in the classroom, he also applied it on the court. Again, here's Carol Sizemore.
Jennings was an excellent educator. He was dedicated in his endeavors in the coaching industry. He was always there to help his students.
He had a style that fit the players. He was easygoing. He would explain things. As long as the players did what they were supposed to do, he was calm, easygoing, and everything. But if they didn't do what they were supposed to do, or they did something crazy, he wasn't adverse to putting his foot down and saying, "Listen, fellas."
That's Gary Dove. He was the official statistician of the Norfolk Blue Demons. The Keystone native was approached by Boyd when he was in the 10th grade about playing basketball for the team, but he instead chose to help out in another way. He spent years at Coach Boyd's side and traveled with the team. Gary witnessed Coach Boyd mold these young men and instill in them a dedication that few would hear of. Coach Boyd commanded respect from his players, but he also rewarded his players for their hard work and dedication to the team. Boyd gave a new pair of sneakers to the leading rebounder, another player with the most leading assists, and he also gave a pair of shoes to the player who has shot the highest percentage of free throws. Joe and David, of course, had their own personal collection.
I know one pair I got was a pair of blue suede Converses. Suede, and they were nice, and I loved them shoes, you know. But
nobody could win the sneakers like me, because when it came to free throw shooting, nobody could outshoot me.
You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Roxy Todd. We've been listening to a story my colleague John Hale produced about his family's high school basketball team, the North Fork Blue Demons. John, around the early 70s, the Blue Demons won their first state championship title. Tell us about that game.
So the year was 1971, and the North Fork Blue Demons went up against Gully Bridge at the brand new West Virginia University Mountaineer Coliseum. Fun fact, this is one of the first games to be played in that brand new Coliseum. The Blue Demons were down by 13 points at the half. And it wasn't because they weren't playing good ball. It's just that the Gully Bridge team was, you know, just a really, really good team. And, you know, for an example, they had a player on Gully Bridge, I believe, that was about like 6'6", almost 300 pounds. So they were getting knocked around a lot. After halftime, you know, their coach, Jennings Boyd, sat there and told them, he said, "Look, fellas, you aren't playing bad ball. They're just outplaying you a little bit." So once they came out, they instituted a defensive tactic called the press. And basically what it is, it's where you apply pressure off of an inbound pass up and down the full length of the court. You would basically run the other team down because your quickness and speed, and you always stay on them in an aggressive-like manner. My Uncle David joked, he said, you know, "We used to press teams to death back in the day." So when you run up and down and you move the game at a faster pace, that creates chaos on the court and in turn would lead to fouls. And the Blue Demons were able to take advantage of that by getting fouls and making all their foul shots in order to keep them up ahead. And that's eventually what gave them the win in the 1971 championship.
Me and my buddy Steve Hudson and Anthony Wheeler was talking about Temptation. That's when Cloud Nine was on. That's when the song Cloud Nine was out. Just so happened, we went out and bought us some hats and put it on. We became the Temptation. Cloud Nine. We was Cloud Nine and everything, man.
Bringing home a state championship was huge for the people of Norfolk. With the odds stacked against him, the Blue Demons were able to turn the tide and beat Galilee Bridge for the 1971 championship.
People was waiting on us in Bluefield and stuff. And they followed. We had like a little tight parade all the way down. And then when we got to the high school, when we got back to the school, the whole parking lot, the whole back of the school was nothing but people and crowds.
Fire trucks from North Fork were up there, and they led a procession down 52 through North Fork, through Keystone, and people out on the streets waving, and just a great amount of pride. The pride that everyone had in the team was tenfold after the championship win.
3 years later, North Fork would again win the state AA championship title. This win would be the first of an 8-year streak for North Fork High School. Joe captained the 74 team and led the Blue Demons to a state championship win over Huntington Vincent.
We as the class of 74, we would always say, well, for that 8 straight, it started with us. We got them ready. We got them ready. We trained them well. And because we trained them well, they trained this next team well. They trained the next team, and it went for, 8 straight state championships. And that's unheard of. And, we're just hard to be beat.
That's it. A national record tying 7 championships. North Fork almost 7. Well, they can erase the almost. They have 7 consecutive championships.
Little old ladies who wouldn't know basketball from football became, big fans because it brought positive notoriety and attention to the community.
When they came back from a championship game, there was a cavalcade of people standing out on the streets, welcoming them back. And it was just pride. It was just, it was like you played in the game. That's how proud you were of the accomplishment.
The Blue Demons were a force to be reckoned with, beating teams that went nearly undefeated during the regular season. This small coal mining town was getting national attention. The townspeople wore jackets and hats that had the slogan, North Fork, West Virginia, basketball capital of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, a new national record for 8 years in a row, the NAA champions of West Virginia.
After college, Joe returned to North Fork and became the assistant coach to Boyd in 1979. Then, in 1983, Joe became the new head coach of the North Fork Blue Demons, a task that he did not take lightly.
Honestly, it was kind of scary. I was nervous. I was nervous a lot of days, a lot of nights. I was very, very nervous because of the tradition that North Fork had. Who wouldn't be?
After a 2-year absence from the state tournament, Joe led the Blue Demons to win the 1984 state championships. This win felt like the comeback the town needed, desperately. Because in 84, jobs in North Fork were really starting to disappear. Eastern Coal, the largest coal mine in the county, had shut down operations. And in the midst of that, the high school winning the state title just felt like there was a ray of hope in sight. And then, everything changed.
I started getting into a groove, and then they closed the school down.
When we come back from the break, we'll hear how the people of North Fork reacted to losing the high school. And we'll travel to a museum that honors all the sports teams in one community that were lost to school consolidation. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Stewart's Opera House, presenting the Nelsonville Music Festival in Nelsonville, Ohio, June 6th through the 9th, featuring Death Cab for Cutie, Mavis Staples, Tyler Childers, The Breeders, The Wood Brothers, Mandolin Orange, and many more acts on 5 stages over 4 days. Tickets and information at nelsonvillefest.org. Today we're looking at how school consolidation affects communities and what happens to local sports pride when schools close. There are many trickle-down effects when schools close, but today we decided to focus on sports, and in particular, basketball. Before the break, we heard how one high school in McDowell County, North Fork, won the state basketball tournament 8 years in a row. But as we'll hear next, just when things were starting to look up in 1984, people in North Fork faced a new challenge. Again, here's John Hale.
After setting a national record in high school basketball and winning another title in 84, people in North Fork were feeling pretty good about their high school and community. That's why this news came as a complete shock. Here's Gary Duff.
The way Jim Lane, our principal, found out about it was one of the board members who had voted against it called him that night and told him that, quote, we closed your high school tonight, and end quote, and, you know, he wasn't even aware of the fact that they were even going to consider it, let alone, you know, vote on it.
We didn't see it coming. I can remember coming down the hallway the next morning, and I was talking to one of the teachers, and she said, I spoke to her. I said, good morning, how are you today? And she looked at me, and she said, oh, it's not a good morning. And I said, it's not? No, no. She said, you don't know? And I said, no, I don't know. What's going on? And then she told me that they had voted the night before to close the school.
With everything that Norfolk had accomplished, why now? What was the reason to close a school that not only had an impressive sports record, but was vital to the community?
I believe, personally, that was a political decision. This way, I really believe it was a political decision because Norfolk was getting too much attention for a little small town like this. And with all the goodness that was going on.
People were just devastated, appalled that they would do something like that.
The school's fate came down to the vote of 5 Board of Education members. 3 of the 5 chose to close the school. After a heated back and forth, 2 of the board members urged their counterparts to reconsider. But the 3 board members who wanted the school closure were adamant in their decision. Norfolk High School was to be no more. The students of Norfolk High organized a mass walkout once the news came, and even organized a protest against the board's decision. The community organized a small committee to hopefully change the board's mind.
Down the line, we were going to end up having to litigate. We got a lawyer out of Parkersburg, William Jacobs, who filed an injunction to stop the closing of the school. That went to circuit court down here. The judge ruled that it would be stopped and certain things had to happen. Long story short, we went all the way to the State Board of Education, and they upheld the county ruling, but the legislature after that, we had talked to the legislative, some of our legislative members, and they made it a law that you have to have public hearings now. You can't just have a meeting and say, we're going to close the school.
Several years prior, 2 rival schools, Gary and Welch, had been merged together into 1, a new school building on top of a former mountaintop removal site called Mount View. Mount View became a bitter rival to the Blue Demons in the years leading up to the big consolidation. Now all the kids in the county were squeezed into 1 school, on top of a hill. I asked my Uncle Joe, how did the students and parents adjust to the forced consolidation?
Not very well. Not because you got these communities that are always rivals against each other. And you got the parents and people who are always, you know, rooting against this other town and all. Now all of a sudden, you all, your kids are all on the same team. So it was a lot of tension going on at Mount View High School.
It was never a cohesive atmosphere. Never. And even with Gary and Welch, it still wasn't the ideal place. The Blue Demons, I felt, they felt rejected in one way by just saying, oh, well, forget about your school. Come here and be happy about it.
This didn't feel right. None of it did. The way the voting went down, the urgency to close the school with no notice, I'm left scratching my head wondering why. Norfolk had the population to keep the school, their building was intact, and they were receiving national attention for their sports legacy. So why would a school like Norfolk be merged with a school outside of its conference?
Norfolk was a double-A school until the day they closed the doors. It was still double-A.
After the school closed, David says he could really see the town fading.
The closing of the school, that's when you really seen some declining around here. Because if you ain't got kids in the neighborhood and you ain't doing no business in your own town, that drags everything down. If it ain't no school, that means you ain't got no jobs for teachers, and the coal fields is closing down too. That's when I actually seen the decline starting in 85. If you went to Norfolk and had some things going on at Norfolk, that was real personal that they closing the school, you know, because I got some history in there and some story, lots of stories. So that was heartbreaking. That was really heartbreaking that they closed the school like that.
You might be wondering what happened to the trophies from Norfolk. Well, when Norfolk High closed, the trophies were moved to the local Norfolk Museum. After that building began to fall into disrepair, they were then moved to City Hall, where they reside till this day. Years of accomplishments and the namesake of a small town now sit in a tiny bank vault in City Hall.
There's no one thing that's going to be a saving grace. Right now, we're working on Band-Aids. And soon the disease will be gone. As the doctor says, you'll never be 100% yourself, but you'll feel 100% better.
Norfolk and McDowell County as a whole has seen some rough times over the past few years. A majority of the coal mines in McDowell County ceased production. And in 2001, violent floods tore through the community, taking with it a majority of the remaining infrastructure as well as the population. When I drive down to Norfolk, it's hard to imagine how great this little town was. I'm able to see a lot of the landmarks my uncles recall when they speak of the good times, but now, a lot of those buildings just sit empty and abandoned. The streets really don't have that much traffic, other than a few coal trucks and the trains that run through the town. I think to myself, what would I do if a place I love so much slowly faded away? How would I feel?
It hurts me because I can remember when it was, it wasn't the way it is now. I can remember when, you know, there was a coal mine every 5 miles.
Just to come back and see the decline where all the houses used to be. Ain't nothing but weeds now, you know. All that hurts when this used to be a special place.
When at least get on your radar that something need to be done about this property?
The first time I went in to see if there was any memorabilia, it was already abandoned, and the doors were either broken into, open, blatantly open, or rusted off, or, you know, some way pried open. And I went in and I saw the gym, and I knew.
When Norfolk High closed, it was made into a middle school. And in 2002, the decision was made to close the school permanently. Throughout the years, due to vandalism and neglect, the town made the tough decision to tear down the old building.
I see the roof getting ready to...
You see daylight.
Yeah, I see daylight coming through. That's bad.
That's bad, but here, it's even worse. There's a whole section that's completely gone.
Just to see them even think about turning it down, it's sad. It's just a sad thing. See the town go down, the county go down, and then see the school, that all that history. Now, when I ain't here to tell it, and my couple other friends, classmates, ain't here to tell these stories, ain't gonna be no story.
It's sad to see what's happened to the town of Norfolk, but this story isn't an isolated incident. There are small towns all around Southern West Virginia that seem to be just barely hanging on. state lawmakers grapple with population loss and how devastating it is to the West Virginia economy. Carol Sosmore still works in Norfolk, and through the combined effort of elected officials, they were able to get grants for a new water system in the small town, as well as attract tourists who come to the area to ride four-wheelers along the Hatfield-McCoy Trail. North Fork was a powerhouse of a town, from the economic wealth from coal production to the athletic achievements that garnered national attention from across the country. It's easy to forget that without the community of people that made up this small coal town, none of this would have been possible. During the production of this piece, Marco Del Page, my Uncle Joe, passed away following a sudden illness. I'm grateful that I had time to sit down with him and recount his career as a basketball player, a coach, and an educator. He was a great man who left an impact on so many people who were fortunate to know him. This piece is dedicated to his memory.
Like John's family and the people of North Fork, lots of people still feel a powerful sense of school spirit, even after their schools have closed, including me. I'll tell you my high school story at the end of our episode. Maybe part of the reason school pride lasts even past when schools close is due to a feeling of nostalgia, for times gone by or a longing for simpler times. But as we'll hear next, sometimes even after a school closes, there's a way to hold on to this identity in a tangible, meaningful way. Another story of school closure takes us to Preston County, West Virginia. It's in the northern corner of the state, bordering Maryland and Pennsylvania. Today, there's only one Central High School, but there was a time when there were 10, and the rivalry and team spirit among the schools was strong. Former students from the original 10 schools banded together to create the Preston County Sports Museum to help memorialize the sports league of years past. It's the only one of its kind in the state. Inside Appalachia Folklife reporter Caitlin Tan visited the museum and spoke with a brother and sister who graduated from Rawlsburg High School in the 1950s. George and Anna Nassif feel so strongly about their school pride, they helped build a museum to preserve the county's sports legacy.
I'm walking into a large red brick building from the early 1900s. It was once the Rawlsburg High School, but today it's a piece of history. Inside is the old basketball gym. It's smaller than today's courts, and at the end of the room is a stage. George and Anna Nassif are in the gym waiting to show me the sports museum upstairs. They are siblings, and they both attended Rawlsburg High. Anna graduated in 1951 and George in 1958. And Rawlsburg High closed in 1985.
I mean, there was a lot of weeping and mourning going on, especially in the elders and the people who graduated from here. And it was a terrible loss, and I don't think people have gotten over it.
There were originally 10 high schools in the county up until 1957. They included Arthurdale, Aurora, Brewston, Fellowsville, Kingwood, Masontown Valley, Newburgh, Rawlsburg, Terra Alta, and Tunnelton. One by one, they closed over the course of 34 years. And by 1991, all the county students were attending Preston High School in the town of Kingwood. In closing those 10 schools, the county lost 10 competitive sports teams and the rich sports legacy each team built over the decades. So with help from other former students, Anna designed the Preston County Sports Museum. It opened in 2014. George and Anna take me up 2 flights of stairs to see the exhibit. We stop to look at a wall of framed photos of war veterans, but George and Anna remember them more as legendary athletes.
And this fellow was the best basketball player ever come out of Rawlsburg, James Ayersman. He would give demonstrations dribbling between his legs and so forth.
Who was that, George?
Blinky Ayersman.
We have a picture of him.
At the top of the stairs, the hallway opens up into a big hall of memorabilia. There are mannequins sporting their original sports uniforms, and there are 10 banners on the wall recognizing each of the schools in their Hall of Fame. They even painted the walls a color that wouldn't favor any one school's colors.
To insist on, we're going to have this hall, it's going to be painted this color, not green, not purple, gray, so that all the colors could come out.
On the left is a room dedicated to the high school teams that formed during the years of consolidation. But on the right is a room featuring all the original schools. It's a dark room with spotlights shining on 10 different sports displays, each representing one of the schools. The structure of all the displays is the same, as to not prioritize any one school. They are handmade, including a table with a wooden backdrop to hang things on. There are awards, photos, letterman jackets, shoes, jerseys, all donated from former players and their families. People who at one point were fierce competitors, and even without the schools, there's still some rivalry. So keeping all the memorabilia in Rollsburg was contentious.
Well, to ask people to bring their things to Rollsburg nine other towns, I didn't think it was possible.
There's a CD featuring former students singing their school's song, but Anna sings me the Rollsburg fight song.
Loyal sons and daughters, we of the dear old Rollsburg High had her name in glorious glee.
George played all the sports offered at Rollsburg, football, baseball, and basketball. Walking through the museum, he remembers games as if they were yesterday.
When we played the first football game under the lights, September 6, 1957 in Kingwood, the whole town of Rollsburg came over to watch us. I won't tell you, we played Terre Haute and our nemesis, Ron Lewis. His shoes are over there, and I'm sure I got a few cleats in me from those shoes.
George has stories for almost every piece of memorabilia in each display. He points out a 1957 basketball team photo in the Rollsburg display.
We were going to play against that darn team over there, Aurora. They beat us and went all the 3 points and went all the way to the final.
He points out a picture in the Aurora display. It's of Bucky Byard. He was one of the top athletes in the whole county, and he could only see out of one eye.
I got to play against him my freshman year. He was a senior. When he jumped, I mean, his legs were so strong. He was only about 5'10", but way up there. And when he shot, he knew where the ball was going if he missed.
Bucky averaged 30 points a game. There's records of the score from almost every sports game between the 10 high schools in the museum. George says every game was packed with the high school's respective towns. It was like an entire sports league all within one county. In fact, it's believed that the organized basketball league among the 10 high schools was the first of its kind in the state. George remembers one basketball game at Fellowsville High School.
But it was famous because it was a very tight stadium, very close in, it was hot, and tempers fired up.
Right behind the one basket net were the bleachers. So the crowd did things that would never be allowed today.
So when you shoot a foul shot, they'd shake that and the ball would bounce out.
There's also stories of people pulling players' pants down or throwing a Coke bottle at them.
But it was all in good fun. Nobody ever got hurt.
There was also a lot of chanting from the crowds. George and Anna sang some of the old Rollsburg cheers, where their colors were orange and black.
Orange and black, set them back, way back, right?
No, it's, you can. You can. You know you can, you must. Beep, 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 Kingwood High School. Beep, 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 Kingwood High School. Yay.
The high schools formed the identity of a lot of the small towns in Preston County. The way Anna speaks of the original 10 high schools and the towns they were in, it's almost as if they are synonymous. She uses the words town and school interchangeably.
If you look around in here, there are 10 mascots for each of the 10 original towns.
And Anna says a bit of each town died as the 10 high schools closed.
The feeling of loyalty toward a place, toward your roots, I don't think it happened with those kids that graduated in the last 20-some years.
It's not necessarily that students in Preston County don't care, but rather they just don't know about the history. The glory days of the 10 high schools and their sports teams was over 60 years ago. George says he was surprised while leading a tour of the exhibit with some sixth graders from Aurora last year. He showed them the picture of Bucky Byard, the one that he showed me where you can notice Bucky's blind eye.
Here's Bucky Byard. What do you think? And they all look quizzical. So you know Bucky? No, they didn't know Bucky Byard from Aurora. So that's what we're talking about.
And that's why George and Anna are so passionate about the museum. They want today's kids growing up in Rollsburg or Terre Alta or any town in Preston County to understand and cherish that history, to have a love for their small town and the sports heroes that came before them.
Rollsburg High, hip, hip, hooray. Here's good health to her today. Lightly may the years go by.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Rollsburg, West Virginia.
Happy days at Rollsburg High.
A major flood took out the Rollsburg High School building in 1985. Anna Nassif describes the scene at the school when the closure was announced.
Well, I think the spirit was damaged permanently. And I saw it in this most recent drive to close Rollsburg and Fellowsville schools, where the people were completely overwhelmed, don't you think, George? They had an attitude of hopelessness that we were going to lose the school anyway, no matter what we did, whether the people voted or didn't vote.
Floods are one reason school districts consolidate, and so are economic challenges and population decline. About 950 schools closed across the U.S. in 1996. By 2017, nearly two decades later, almost double that number of schools were closed, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. Education policymakers in favor of school consolidation say students will find more enriched classes and activities like after-school options by combining students into a centralized school building and by combining resources. However, those opposed to school consolidation point out the negative impacts to communities. One researcher at the University of Dayton put it like this: "The school district is the glue that holds the community together." The National Education Policy Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder published another report that says, quote, "Larger school and district sizes are associated with reduced rates of student participation, more dangerous school environments, lower graduation rates, and larger achievement gaps along lines of poverty, race, and gender," end quote. Consolidation can also drain money away from local economies. An article in Education Week said closing entire districts can push communities already facing economic decline nearer the edge. Why? This could be because as kids are bused across the other towns, the community doesn't have much of a reason to support local restaurants, gas stations, or stores. It also could lead to families leaving to be closer to schools. There aren't many studies about the economic impacts on local communities aside from anecdotal research. If you have thoughts on how school consolidation has impacted your local community, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is insideappalachia@wvpublic.org, or our Twitter handle is @inappalachia. How does school consolidation affect the participation in after-school activities? After all, some of the benefits of consolidation are that more resources can be used for things like football or math club or track teams. But on the negative side, when kids have to travel further to school, it can be challenging to get a ride home if you're in an after-school activity. Parents, including myself, end up shuttling kids around just to get them to their sports and dance practices. So what's the big deal about after-school activities anyway? Well, on average, children who participate in after-school activities have higher GPAs. They're more likely to graduate high school, and they have higher attendance at school, according to our next guest, Dr. Sandra Simpkins, a professor in the School of Education at the University of California in Irvine.
I mean, activities have played an important role in our society for a long time, particularly when women started going back to work, that oftentimes it was seen as a way to help supervise children during the after-school hours. During wartime, there are actually studies showing that children helped with war efforts. And now it's been seen as a way for children to explore different aspects of themselves, and often aspects that, because of decreasing budgets at the school, like for arts and for sports, that they don't, it's the only place that they can explore some of these things. So after school is still seen as a time to help provide a safe, supervised place for youth after school. And it helps youth to not be involved in delinquency or other problem behavior after school. But it's also seen as more of a place where youth can explore their identity, who they are, what they're good at. And it's also a place where youth learn things such as social-emotional skills. People talk a lot about social-emotional learning right now, and that those really help those skills, like emotion, regulating one's emotions, learning about teamwork in sports, that those skills really help youth not just achieve in life, but achieve in the classroom.
And here in Appalachia and across the nation, we're in the midst of, as you know, a big opioid epidemic. And I hear parents oftentimes spend so much time and energy bringing their kids to extracurricular activities, specifically as a way to keep them engaged in some activity so they don't get bored, so they don't have a lot of time on their hands. But I imagine that, you know, I'm hearing you talk about as kids get to adolescence and get to high school, that more and more they rely on the schools to provide some of those extracurricular activities. And I imagine that here in the coalfields, as schools are losing some of that extracurricular activity, it might also open the door for more kids out there, as you said, to get involved in some problem behavior and maybe get around some communities that they maybe shouldn't be associated with.
Right. So when you look at the research, the time when children or adolescents are most likely to engage in drug use or problem behaviors is actually during the after-school hours on Monday through Friday between 3 and 8 p.m. And it's when they're typically not being supervised by an adult and they're hanging out with peers. Now, that's not always the active ingredients, right, for problem behavior, that there are many teens who don't get into those types of endeavors after school, but it does. That's typically the context that promotes the kind of, whether it's delinquent behavior, sexual activity, you know, those types, other vandalism, those types of delinquent behaviors that usually happens during those times. So activities are a way to help protect youth from being in those contexts or in those spaces. But they're also a place, the other way that they help youth not to use drugs, not to, you know, get engaged with other kids who are, you know, engaged in problematic behavior, is that activities are helping youth feel good about themselves. They're helping youth find passion, to help youth find that, you know, realize that what they do actually matters in important ways. And when schools consolidate, it would be great if they, you know, because I know some of that is out of the schools, you know, or county's control because of the population loss or population flight. But to think about how are they then going to offer those activities for youth. I've talked with many families when an older adolescent, say, wants to do this activity but can't because they need to babysit a younger sibling. And so if there was coordination, though, across the activities at the varying levels, then I think this might help minimize the effects on activities and then the spillover effects on youth development.
Again, that was Sandy Simpkins, who researches children and adolescents organized after-school activities. She was speaking with Roxy Todd. For our final story, we travel to my hometown of Mullins, which, like so many others across Appalachia, was impacted by school consolidation. I was in the second graduating class of Wyoming East High School. My freshman year, there were four high schools. Now, there are two. Going into my junior year, I knew that it would be tough for my community to get behind the new school. We were passionate about high school sports, especially basketball. It was something that we believed we could win. And often did. And it was always a tough game when we played another team from the county. That was no different during tournaments this year. Games between the Wyoming East Warriors and the Westside Renegades, though, are fierce. At a basketball game between the two rivals a few months ago, a TV crew from 59 News collected these voices from the crowd.
Instead of it being spread out, I mean, now you got a house divided. You got a whole county that's separated with that. And it makes it, I think, you know, just as good. You know, us old school players, we like to think back. We like to look at the way it used to be, and everything was always more grander or better. or more of a rivalry, but it has not stopped. If anything, it has actually increased.
Pass over to York. York tries the three. He nailed it!
We don't like West Side. West Side don't like us. But when we play, it's a really big thing.
It's such an exciting game. I'm friends with people on the both sides, so it's going to be a really good game. And it's so exciting for everybody, and it's one of the best rivalry games in the state.
Let's go.
Hard work on three.
1, 2, 3, hard work!
This rivalry game has been the highlight of my high school career. All 4 years, it's always an exciting game. There's nothing like it. If you haven't been to a West and East rivalry game, you haven't seen nothing.
Those interviews were part of a short video produced by Larry Mars for the CBS affiliate WVNS-TV 59 News. When the schools consolidated, it seemed like the one thing we all had in common was the desire to rally behind our teams, and I have to say, I'm glad to see that tradition carried on. The community also holds on to community roots and the spirit of closed schools with a trophy case that sits outside the school's theater. There you'll find trophies, letterman jackets, and more from some of the consolidated schools in Wyoming County: Glen Rogers, Pineville, Herndon, and Mullins. Still, for graduates of the now-closed Mullins High School, it's hard to imagine going back to cheer on the Warriors rather than the Rebels, like former student Dan D'Antoni.
You know, Mullins is kind of always that school right down the street from me, so it'd be hard for me to adapt over to East. But it got too many rivals in there that we had to fight all the time. But, you know, I'm sure it'd be great, and I should get down there to see that.
But while he's never made it back for an East versus West game, Dan D'Antoni never got far from his roots. Even though basketball took him away from his home, he's now Marshall University's head basketball coach. He's still a proud son of the Mountain State while teaching the world about the unique style of basketball that he says came from the courts he grew up on. Eric Douglas sat down with D'Antoni while the Thundering Herd basketball team warmed up for practice.
Long before Dan D'Antoni became the head basketball coach for Marshall University, he got his start playing in Mullins, West Virginia. The family lived close to the former high school and an outdoor basketball court that was frequently filled with players.
I always told somebody you had to shoot real fast because, first of all the courts were uneven, you might lose your dribble, and if you shot it and missed, it'd go down the side of a hill.
He calls it West Virginia basketball. You have to make quick plays and improvise often.
So you learn to go real fast, shoot real quick, and make it, because if not, it'd go down the hill, you'd have to chase it.
He has another term for this style of ball. He calls it hillbilly ball. And while he admits the word hillbilly does have negative connotations for some people, he thinks West Virginians should reclaim it.
First of all, hillbilly was probably coined and defined by people from New York who have no idea what the people in Appalachia and how they live and who they are and the type of people. So, you know, I wanted to change it and give it a good connotation. Look, this is what hillbillies look like. And we put a team out there that's efficient. They're clean-cut young men who carry themselves well, represent the basketball program academically and on the court. And I wanted to give people, this is a new look. This is really what a hillbilly stands for: hardworking, creative, able to accomplish things.
D'Antoni grew up in Mullins while his dad, the late Louis D'Antoni, led the Mullins Running Rebels to a state title in 1955. Basketball was a huge part of his life. He recalls a childhood in the 1950s and 60s where basketball was becoming more important in southern West Virginia and around the country.
Well, I grew up in an environment where Jerry West and Willie Akers and Hal Greer and Leo Bird, basketball was the rage in the towns throughout really southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky, Indiana, and that type of atmosphere where towns came out to watch games. It was the thing to do on weekdays and weekends.
Louis D'Antoni pushed young kids to get out and play basketball in one of the 5 outdoor courts. He even helped to construct some of the community courts when they were built. The courts became a gathering place for young people and almost a sort of training ground for players that helped Mullins earn 7 state titles.
As a young kid, Mullins was the Hoosiers before the movie. And won a state title from a very small school when there were no classifications. They were runners-up, they were champions, and they were semifinalists, the last one being beaten by West. You know, those were right in my formative years to where, you know what, it was a great, I know how the feeling I had and the passion that it gave me to play basketball. And it was all my life, I guess I've been chasing that to repeat the experience.
Mullen sent two players to the NBA, Jerome Anderson and Mike D'Antoni, Dan's brother. Mike now coaches the NBA's Houston Rockets. The D'Antoni family contributed to a foundation that's working to restore the Mullins basketball courts of D'Antoni's youth.
We played constantly there, and hopefully that'll be of use for anyone else, young person coming through, that they can go out and find the same passion we found on that court.
The West Mullins playground will be dedicated to Louis D'Antoni later this year. Coach D'Antoni said he was proud of his upbringing and hopes, with the style of play he coaches, to get others excited about hillbilly ball as well.
I take away that last little stigma they throw on us sometimes and say, you know what, maybe you gotta change. Maybe I want to be a hillbilly when they see us play.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas.
Earlier in the show, we heard a brother and sister who still sing their school's fight song decades after they graduated, and it reminded me of my own school story. I cheered throughout high school, and at Mullins, during my freshman year, the school fight song was a big part of how we supported our teams. We'd sing it with the band at football games. There was something really amazing about doing chants or cheers and seeing several generations in the stands doing it together. We may not have had much more in common outside of those songs, but we did have common ground in the stadium during the games. I felt like we all had a common goal in those moments. The feeling, as I recall, was kind of magical. Even though the school is now closed, I too carry the chants and songs of my old, now consolidated high school with me. Throughout the show, we heard from several people who attended schools that are now gone. And while they still have Letterman jackets, trophies, and yearbooks, those items really don't mean anything without the personal stories and connections that come with them. They might have lost their high school, but they haven't lost their spirit. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Michael Howard, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.